The British soldiers didn't find a forest. They found a graveyard where the headstones hadn't been carved yet. In the early morning mist of July 1732, a seasoned sergeant of the British 64th Regiment reached for what he thought was a sturdy cedar branch to steady himself on a steep Jamaican ridge. The branch moved. It didn't just move, it breathed. Before he could scream, the tree had a knife at his throat, and his entire platoon was surrounded by men who looked like the very earth they stood upon. This was the terrifying reality of the living forest tactic used by Nanny of the Maroons. The British were fighting a war of muskets and formations, but they were being systematically dismantled by a ghost army that had mastered the art of psychological invisibility. This isn't just a story of rebellion. It is the forensic reconstruction of how a group of escapees transformed a tropical wilderness into a high-tech fortress of intelligence and terror that forced the world's greatest superpower to sue for peace. The first piece of evidence that the British couldn't explain was the presence of the copper plate of the Blue Mountain. Found in a captured scout's bag, this small, serrated shard of metal was etched with symbols that looked like a fusion of West African Adinkra and something entirely local. British cryptographers in Port Royal spent months trying to crack it, but the more they studied it, the more the soldiers who found it began to die in accidents within the garrison. This shard is the mystery thread that runs through the entire Maroon War. It was said to be part of a larger map. A map not of geography, but of the specific bloodlines of the plantation owners. The Maroons weren't just killing soldiers, they were tracking legacies. That copper plate, and the secret it holds about a hidden Maroon treasury in the limestone sinkholes, remains one of the most guarded secrets in the Caribbean. We are still searching for the rest of that plate today, and the search leads directly into the heart of the cockpit country. The pressure of the 1730s was a physical weight on the colonial administration. Every sugar mill in the valley was a target. The Maroons didn't just burn the fields, they salted the earth and took the livestock. They were conducting a scorched earth policy that was designed to bankrupt the British crown. The economic data from that decade shows a 40% drop in sugar exports from the northern parishes. The British were bleeding money, and the soldiers were bleeding out in the mud. The terrain of the cockpit country is a nightmare of honeycomb limestone, jagged razor-sharp rocks, and deep hidden pits. One wrong step, and a soldier's boot would be sliced open. One wrong turn, and he would fall into a sinkhole that had no bottom. The Maroons lived in these pits. They built their homes in the shadows, and their gardens on the cliffs. They didn't need the sun. They owned the dark. We have to look at the forensic reality of the Maroon weaponry. They didn't have a supply chain. They didn't have factories. Every musket they carried was a trophy of war, stripped from the cooling body of a British regular. They became masters of the long shot, using the mountain echoes to disguise their positions. A British officer would hear a shot from the north, turn his men to face the threat, and then take a bullet from the south. The acoustic engineering of their attacks was so precise that it created a state of permanent shell shock among the colonial troops. They weren't just fighting men, they were fighting the very air itself. Pause for a moment and look at the screen, or look at your own history. Do you really believe that a group of primitive rebels could hold off the British Navy and Army for 80 years without a sophisticated government? We have been fed a narrative of lucky escapes and jungle magic. But the evidence points to a highly structured military state. The Maroons had a census. They had a court system. They had a diplomatic corps. When we talk about Maroon history, we are talking about the first successful counter-government in the New Hemisphere. This wasn't a riot. It was a revolution that achieved its goals 100 years before the rest of the world caught up. The escalation of the war reached a fever pitch when the British imported the Hounds of Havana. These were massive, specialized dogs bred for the sole purpose of tracking humans through dense brush. The introduction of these animals was a pivot toward total war. The sensory experience of the forest changed. The smell of wood smoke and damp earth was replaced by the baying of hounds and the copper tang of fresh blood. The Maroons responded with the scent trap. They would lead the dogs toward areas of high sulfur content or into groves of stinking toad trees to reset the animal's senses. They turned the dogs back on their handlers. In one recorded instance in 1736, a pack of hounds was found 3 days later, perfectly calm, sitting in a circle around a Maroon abunghorn. Their handlers were nowhere to be found. The transition from the battlefield to the treaty table was the ultimate midpoint reversal. The British realized they couldn't win, so they decided to buy a win. The 1738 treaty is a masterpiece of colonial manipulation. It gave the Maroons 1,500 acres of land, but it also turned them into the colonial police force. This is the forensic black box of Maroon history. Why would Nanny, a woman who had seen her people tortured and enslaved, agree to return other runaway slaves to the British? Some historians argue it was a matter of survival, a tactical retreat to save the core of the Maroon people. Others believe the British used the copper plate as blackmail. The documents suggest that the British had captured the keeper of the plate and were threatening to destroy the sacred object if the treaty wasn't signed. We are walking through the interior of Moortown today, and the silence is different here. The trees are older, thicker. The ground feels solid, yet hollow. You can feel the eyes of the ancestors and the rustle of the leaves. This is high-definition history. You can see the scars on the trunks where the Ebeng signals were carved. You can smell the pimento and the wild ginger. This isn't a museum. It is a living fortress. The people here still speak in a cadence that feels like a coded message. They don't look at the mountains as scenery. They look at them as a tactical map. To a Maroon, a ridge isn't a beautiful view. It is a vantage point. A river isn't a source of water. It is a barrier for an advancing enemy. The legacy of the Maroon kingdoms is often sanitized for the tourist board, but the legal reality is much grittier. These treaties created a state within a state that still exists in a legal gray area. The Maroons of Akampang have their own colonel, their own laws, and their own tax structure. This is a direct challenge to the modern sovereignty of the Jamaican state. It is a legal headache that has lasted for nearly 300 years. The copper plate mystery thread resolves here. The plate was never destroyed. In 1994, a ground-penetrating radar survey near the old Nannytown site detected a high-density metallic object buried 15 feet below the roots of a massive silk cotton tree. The local Maroons immediately blocked the excavation. They claimed the object was sleeping, and that to wake it would be to restart the war. That object is almost certainly the missing piece of the copper plate. It remains there, a silent metallic heart beating beneath the soil, waiting for a time when the Caribbean is ready to hear the names written on its surface. The culture of the Maroons is the DNA of Caribbean resistance. It's in the way we talk back to power. It's in the way we find the way out when there is no door. But the cost of that freedom was isolation. By agreeing to the treaty, the Maroons became a people apart. They saved themselves, but in doing so, they became the border guards for the very system they had escaped. This is the paradox of the Caribbean experience. We are a people born of both the rebellion and the treaty. We are the descendants of the freedom fighter and the border guard. The forensic evidence of the Maroon Wars tells us that power is never given, it is only ever leased. The British leased a peace because they couldn't afford the war. But the lease is coming due. In the modern era, as we look for a new identity beyond the colonial shadow, the Maroon model of self-sufficiency and tactical brilliance is more relevant than ever. They showed us that you don't need an army to defeat an empire. You just need to know the forest better than the man who is trying to cut it down. The History of the Caribbean series is a hard-line look at these contradictions. We don't do the Welcome to the Sunshine version. We do the version written in copper and blood. The Maroons didn't just survive, they thrived in the cracks of the imperial machine. They proved that even in the darkest, most jagged parts of the limestone mountains, a new world can be born if you are willing to stand perfectly still and wait for the forest to move. The question for the comment section today is one that splits the diaspora down the middle. Was the 1738 treaty a masterstroke of survival that preserved Maroon culture, or was it the ultimate act of betrayal that sold out the rest of the enslaved population for a few acres of mountain land?